Hi, this is Pastor and Bible teacher Warren Hoyt, welcoming you to another audio message of the Word of God, which, according to Acts 20:32, is able to build you up and give you an inheritance among God's people. Today, I want to address a couple of questions that people frequently ask. One is, why are there so many religions? And the other, why are there so many versions of the Bible? I'm often asked these questions. And sometimes the questions are wrongly phrased. I want to deal with the first question about religions briefly, and I'll spend the majority of the time today on the second question about versions. When people say, why are there so many religions, sometimes they're informed people, and so that's a legitimate question because they know what they're talking about, different actual conceptions of reality, right? And so if you're thinking of that, then there are many religions. The top world religions in terms of followers are Christianity at 2.3 billion, Islam at 1.8 billion, Hinduism 1.1 billion, Buddhism at 500 million, Shintoism at 104 million. There are other religions with less followers, like Sikhism at 25 million, Judaism with 14 million, Taoism at 12 million. And then there are things like Satanism, Wicca, paganism, and different sects of Islam, and many, many Christian cults. And by that, I mean you call them Christian because they seem a little bit outwardly like Christianity, but they hold to beliefs that are at variance from orthodoxy. And so they're really not Christian. No. But anyway, the subject is vast, and we could spend a lot of time on it. But for now, I assume you know that since I'm a Christian pastor, I believe Christianity is the only true religion. And I could spend time validating that, but that's not my emphasis today. The issue is that a lot of people who ask, why are there so many religions, they're not phrasing the question right. What they really mean is, why are there so many different expressions or denominations of Christianity? That's a totally different question. Because the different denominations, they're not different religions. So you really shouldn't say, you know, the Baptists are a different religion from the Methodists or the Presbyterians or the Church of God or, you know, something like that. Don't say that, because those are not different religions. They're just different branches of the one true religion, Christianity. And the reason they exist is because they interpret the Bible differently. They emphasize different aspects of Christian life. They see salvation differently. So they like to worship with their own kind. If you would refer to some of my teachings on church history that I did about a year or so ago, you'll find out where a lot of the denominations came to be, or else get a book on it. I mean, there's a whole history of how these denominations came about, and it's pretty interesting. But you need to know that unless they compromise or change the major doctrines of Christianity or leave something out or distort it or something like of that sort, then they're still Christian. They just have different interpretations of some peripheral type issues. So that being said, if you say, why are there different religions? Well, it's because we see reality different. But don't say different denominations of Christian churches are different religions. So then, now I'm going to turn to the next question. Why are there so many Bibles? And how can we know which is the correct one? Again, many times people don't phrase that question properly. If you're talking about different so-called holy books, like the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedas, the writings of Lao Tzu, stuff like that, well, then you're not right to call them Bibles. Those aren't different Bibles. They're different religious books or holy books that people esteem as revelations from their gods or whatever. But they're not Bibles. There's really just one Bible. And the word Bible actually means books, plural. It's a collection of books. But when people say, why are there so many Bibles, what they generally mean is, why are there so many different versions of the Bible? Like, you know, the New American Standard, the New International, the KJV, the NKJV, the Message, the Amplified, the New Century, etc. See, don't call those different Bibles. They're not different Bibles. They're different versions of the one Bible. And so, you know, you need to phrase the question properly, but then you can go on and say, well, why do we have so many of these? Do they all say the same thing? Can we trust them? To answer that, we need to understand a little bit about how we got our Bible in the first place, right? And of course, this is a vast area of study. I recommend you look into it, and there's lots of books I could recommend. But for now, let me just give you a sort of a brief overview. The Old Testament was written over a period of from about 820 to 1200 years, depending on when you date certain parts of it, and there's some disagreement on that. So it could be from about the 1400s BC to around 430 BC. So it's a vast period of time there. And it was written mostly in Hebrew, though some parts were written in a related language, Aramaic. It was all translated into Greek in the period from around 250 to 200 BC. And that Greek version, which is called the Septuagint, and you'll see it listed as the LXX, the Roman numerals for 70, that version is the version that Jesus and the apostles probably knew and used. Now, so that's the Old Testament. Well, the New Testament was finished in no more than 56 years. See, the whole New Testament was written in no more than 56 years and possibly less than that. And at the very latest, you know, we differ a little bit on the dates of things, but at the very latest, it was finished only 63 years after the death of Christ. I think it was finished in less time than that, but at the very latest, it was finished 63 years after the death of Christ, who's, you know, the main subject of it. The New Testament was all written in what's called Koine Greek. That was the language of the Roman Empire and the whole world, known world of that time. And that was due to the fact that Alexander the Great conquered what we call the Middle East today, and went all the way to India in the 4th century BC. And so he brought the Greek language and Greek culture and stuff to that whole region. And from the earliest times, people began to translate the New Testament because it was more, from the very beginning, a message for all peoples, not just Jews. And so it began to be translated early on into the native languages of the various peoples to which it came. Like, it was translated into Latin, into Syriac, into Arabic, and so forth. And remember, when these translations were made, these copies were made, they were always made by hand. Remember that. They were copied by hand on to such materials as parchment, which is a type of animal skin, vellum, which is an even finer, more processed type of animal skin, and then papyrus, which was the first paper, and it was made from papyrus reeds. And so the New Testament, you know, this was copied and recopied hundreds and thousands of times. Remember that. And no one had a printed Bible until Gutenberg invented the printing press around 1440 AD. So for, you know, when you think of Bibles, you might think of what we have today, you know, the book form of the Bible that we have today, and you might think of it being uniform, you know, mine says exactly what yours says and what hers says and so on, that they're all uniform. But remember, for 1400 years, nobody had a book like that. Everybody had a handwritten copy. And so when you do handwritten copies, especially since in the early days there was a lot of persecution and they were trying to round up copies of the scripture and burn them and so forth, so the copyists would do it in a hurry and quickly spread them from place to place. In those early days, you got a lot of errors because people were copying by hand and doing it in a hurry. And you would have different kinds of print. Some of them would have illustrations. Later on, you know, in the Middle Ages, they put beautiful illustrations and so forth. But just remember, that's what you had, different hand-copied manuscripts. The Hebrew of the Old Testament, remember also, was an ancient biblical Hebrew. And so by the time of the Middle Ages, when there was a group of Jewish scholars called the Masoretes, who kind of formalized the Old Testament into what we call the Masoretic text, or the Textus Receptus. By the time they did that, why, some of those ancient biblical Hebrew words were no longer clearly understood. That's why a lot of times in a version it'll say the original Hebrew is not clear in this verse or something like that, because hundreds of years had passed and they didn't always know what the words meant. But the Masoretic text was put together by these Jewish scholars from around the 6th to the 10th centuries AD. And so, as I say, you know, thousands of copies were made and the word of God was scattered all over the known world. And there's all these different translations in all these different languages. And there are differences between the manuscripts. Now, currently, scholars tell us that they have over 14,000 manuscripts, fragments of manuscripts, I should say, of the New Testament. Over 14,000 fragments. But they have over 5,000, last I heard it was 5,700, I think, whole New Testaments in different languages, mostly in Greek. And so that is a huge number of manuscripts, 14,000 fragments, over 5,000 whole New Testaments. And in those manuscripts, among them, there are some 400,000 differences between them. And if you listen to guys like Bart Ehrman, who's basically a kind of an agnostic or atheist scholar, but a highly renowned New Testament scholar, he'll tell you there's more errors in the New Testament than there are words in the New Testament. So he says you can't trust any of it. But many other scholars will explain to you that's not true. Most of these so-called errors are just minor differences in spelling, and none of them affects a major doctrine. And the thing to remember is the fact that we have so many fragments of manuscripts and whole New Testaments and so forth to look at makes it to where we can have great assurance that we actually do know the correct meaning that the authors were communicating. You know, there's errors, but they're all minor. And I wish I could show you, but I can't on this audio. But, you know, I have examples where you can have a sentence and write it 25 times, the same sentence. And in each sentence, in each version, change just a letter or two, you know. Instead of T-H-E for the, put T-H-H or something like that, you know. The something or other, you know, just change a few letters, different letters through each sentence. And you have 25 versions of the sentence. And in each one, you have one or two letters that are different, or three or four, however many you want. When you look at 25 of them, you can still figure out what the sentence is supposed to say. And that's the way it is. We have a lot of little typos, but nothing that affects any doctrine. And with the thousands of manuscripts we have to look at, it is very safe to say that we can know the meaning of the original authors. Remember, though, that all our Bibles are translations. When you translate from one language to another, I know because I speak Spanish and English, and then I also speak some Russian, and I've studied some other languages, Hebrew and Greek, right? And so if you haven't ever learned another language or translated a language, you may not know this, but when you translate from one language to another, quite often, you cannot say exactly the same thing in the other language because we say things differently because of our culture and the way we think and, you know, the way our language works. Let me illustrate. Years ago, I got picked up. I was helped out on a long trip down into Mexico by a traveling guy who he helped me out and he let me stay in his hotel with him. I met him one afternoon. I didn't have anywhere to stay, and he let me stay in his hotel. So we talked a while, and I think we had coffee or something. And then he got up and he said, "Me baño," and he went into the hotel bathroom to take a shower. Well, "me baño" is how they say it in Spanish, "me baño." And actually, if you translated that literally, it would be "me, I, myself bathe," right? "Myself, I bathe," that kind of thing. Well, we don't say "myself, I bathe." We say something like, "I'm going to take a shower." Well, if you count that, that's six words, but "I'm" is actually a contraction. So you could say it's seven words. "I'm going to take a shower," or I'm going to wash up," or something like that. Well, you get the point, right? Both are saying that the person is going to go into the bathroom and get clean, but one uses two words and the other uses six or seven. So it takes more English words than it does Spanish words to say the same thing. Usually it's the opposite, by the way. Spanish takes more words. But in this case, the Spanish takes less. Well, we just don't say what that guy said in English. We don't say it. So somebody could say, well, the guy, look at whoever translated this is lying. They're distorting the message because the American said six words and the Mexican only said two. But that's not the case. Nobody's lying. Nobody's distorting. It's just that we don't say it exactly the same, right? And there are many cases I've learned over the years as I speak Spanish and preach in Spanish, there are words that we have in English that they just don't say in Spanish. Like, for example, when I preach about righteousness, the word they use in Spanish is justicia, which is justice. Well, you could say justice and righteousness are alike, but they're not exactly alike. To us English speakers, they have different shades of meaning. And so, you know, that's the way it is with the Bible. When you're translating from Hebrew and Greek and from Aramaic and such to English, there are going to be different ways to translate things. And if you have honest scholars doing the translation, their motive is just to help people understand the Word of God better. You don't have to suspect the version they come up with. You just need to be sure that there's no hidden agenda there. Like, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't accept Orthodox Christian teaching about the Trinity or Jesus being God in human flesh. So in their version of the Bible, they got an agenda. They want to get rid of all those kind of references. So they deliberately changed the verses that teach those things. So you got to suspect their version. They have a bias. They have a reason why they want to make it say something different. And there's like a new gender neutral Bible, and that has a feminist bias and so on. But only if there's an open case of bias like that do you need to suspect it. The thing is that there's so many versions of the Bible we can compare. You can't pull a fast one on this. People just need to compare the different versions. Now, a book I want to recommend to you is How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by Douglas Stewart and Gordon Fee. Both of these guys have their doctorates. Douglas Stewart is an Old Testament scholar and Gordon Fee is a New Testament scholar. And these guys, it's an easy read. It's not complicated and scholarly, but it really will help you understand how to interpret the Bible. Let me just tell you a few things that are in their book. On pages 39 through 43, they show actual examples of differences between translations, and they explain how those differences came about. For example, 1 Samuel 8:16. In the NKJV and the NASB, it says, if Israel chooses a king, he, quote, he will take your finest young men and your donkeys. Okay, young men and donkeys. But in the NRSV, the New Revised Standard Version, and the NIV, it says, he will take the best of your cattle and donkeys. So which is it? Young men and donkeys or cattle and donkeys? It's not a huge issue, but which is it? Well, cattle and donkeys comes from the LXX, the Septuagint version. And it's often more reliable than the Masoretic text because that was done in the Middle Ages. And so the other versions used the Masoretic text. But if you think about it, it makes more sense that the verse would say cattle and donkeys than it does to say young men and donkeys. And so since the Greek version says cattle and donkeys, and since the Hebrew word for young men and cattle are very similar with one letter difference, what probably happened was that the Masoretic text was created hundreds of years after the Septuagint version. So a medieval scholar could have made an error, you know, missing one letter. And so he said young men and donkeys instead of cattle and donkeys. And so Gordon Fee and this other scholar, they say, look, you know, probably the NIV and the NRSV are right here. You see, but there's a difference, you know, between versions, and there's a reason for it. Here's another example. Mark 1, verse 2. In the NKJV, it says, as it is written in the prophets. But in the NIV, it says, as it is written in Isaiah, the prophet. Well, which is it? The prophets, plural, or Isaiah, the prophet? Well, these scholars point out that the text of the NIV is found in all the best early Greek manuscripts. And it's also the only text found in all the earliest second century translations, like Latin, Coptic, Syriac, and all that. And it's the only text known among all but one of the church fathers before the 9th century. So we got all these writings of the early church fathers, you know, and they, when they quote it just like the NIV does. And the thing is, the book brings out that it's easy to see why the change was made. Because the words of the prophet are actually the words of two prophets. So when Mark says, as it is written in the prophet Isaiah, well, actually, it's not just in Isaiah. It's in Isaiah 40, but it's also in Malachi 3. So what probably happened is that a copyist who was translating Mark decided to correct what Mark wrote. Mark said it's written in the prophet Isaiah, but he thought, you know, well, that's not right. It's actually in Malachi and Isaiah. So he thought, I'll correct it. And so even though the inspired author, Mark, wrote what seems like an error, it's written in the prophet Isaiah when actually it's written in two prophets, the copyist thought it would be good to correct Mark. And so he did it. But actually, I don't think it's wise to try to correct an inspired author of Scripture. And so the more correct translation is the literal one in the NIV that says Isaiah the prophet, even though there was actually a prophecy of Malachi as well. Do you want translators to add to God's word? By the way, there's a scholar I respect, Dr. Michael Brown. He explains, you know, why Mark might have seemed to make a mistake there, but there's actually a whole other explanation. It's pretty cool, but I don't have time for it today. But I'm just showing you how things can come out differently in different versions. Here's another example, 1 Corinthians 6:20. The NKJV says, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. But the NIV just says, therefore honor God with your bodies. It doesn't say, and in your spirit. This example, according to Fee and Stewart, you know, the writers of how to read the Bible for all it's worth, it illustrates how sometimes copyists change a text for theological reasons. The words, and in your spirit, which are God's, they don't appear in any early Greek manuscript or in the early Latin-speaking manuscripts. So if Paul had actually written such a thing as, you know, in your spirit, which is God's, well, then how in the world do you explain how all those early manuscripts left it out? But what happened is the later copyists were in monasteries, and it was a time when Greek philosophy was really making inroads into Christian theology, and Greek philosophy had a low view of the body. The body's bad, we need to escape from our bodies, and so on. So Gordon Fee says it's probable that some monks added the words in your spirit and then concluded that both body and spirit are God's. Now, what they wrote there is true. There's, you know, your spirit and your body are both God's. But it's probable that they added that. And in doing so, they kind of changed Paul's emphasis. He was talking about what we do with our physical bodies. He didn't take time to speak about that your spirit is also from God, because he was focusing on you're responsible for what you do in your body. But you see, a later medieval copyist changed and added words there for his theological reasons. Here's another example. 1 Corinthians 13:3. The manuscripts for this verse are evenly divided between various interpretations. It's really interesting. Listen, in the 1984 NIV, it's translated this way. You know, Paul's talking about, you know, what love is, and even if I surrender my body to the flames, it says in the 1984 NIV. But it includes a note which says, or if I surrender my body that I may boast. But in the 2011 NIV, it looks like this. The text says, if I give over my body to hardship that I may boast, and then the note at the bottom says, if I give over my body to the flames. Now, you know, you read this and you go, why? You know, why does it say it differently? Well, Gordon Fee says in Greek, the difference is only one letter, kalkesomai versus kalthesomai. You hear that? Kalkesomai versus kalthesomai. And so he says, boast, the word boast has the best Greek support. Flames doesn't appear until way later in later, you know, manuscripts, when Christians were actually being burned at the stake. Both words have grammatical difficulties. Flames represents a form that is ungrammatical in Greek, but also Paul's letter was written long before people were being burned at the stake. And so no one ever volunteered to give their body over to be burned. So it doesn't make sense. On the other hand, though the word boast is better grammatically, and it has a whole lot more manuscript evidence, it's difficult to explain what it's meant, what is meant by this phrase, you know, that I may boast. And so, you know, it's just difficult for the translators to understand, and what they have to do is kind of make their best guess. I like this example, especially because it really will make it clear. Let me tell you this one. 1 Corinthians 7:36, in the NKJV, it says, if any man thinks that he is behaving improperly toward his virgin. Well, what does that mean? What virgin? The NASB says, if any man thinks he's acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter. But the NIV says, if anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably toward the virgin he's engaged to. Then the New English Bible puts it this way. If a man has a partner in celibacy and feels that he's not behaving properly towards her. Well, my goodness, those are just totally different translations, right? Which one is right? You see, Paul was answering somebody's question. He didn't intend to be ambiguous here. The Corinthians, actually, we know that they wrote him and asked him questions. And so he was trying to answer their questions. He wasn't trying to be ambiguous, but it's like you hear a person talking on the phone and you know they have the phone up to their ear and you can hear what they say, but you don't know what the other person is saying because it's inside the phone, right? That's the way this is. We don't know what they ask Paul. We know what Paul is saying, but we don't know what question he's addressing and what the problem was and what he's trying to talk about. We don't know any of that stuff. So translators just have to look at the words and try to figure it out. You know, what's it talking about? Is it talking about a virgin daughter or a virgin fiance or what? You know, this partner in celibacy that the New English says. What is that? Actually, all the translations are legit in terms of, you know, could you translate the Greek to say that? Well, yeah, you could. But what was the original question that was asked of Paul, and what was his answer? Gordon Fee is a New Testament scholar. He says the NIV translation is best. And that's what it makes more sense if you think about it. If anybody's worried that he might not act honorably toward the virgin he's engaged to, that makes sense, right? But, I mean, this partner in celibacy thing doesn't make sense. And actually, you know, your virgin daughter, that doesn't make much sense. Why would you act unbecomingly toward your virgin daughter? It doesn't make sense unless you're a pervert. And then the NKJV, it just translates it literally, but it doesn't help at all because it just says behaving improperly toward his virgin. Well, what virgin? Who's a virgin? What do you mean? So that's just to give you an understanding of why we have different translations and why sometimes they're difficult. Now, in the book, it also talks about how the KJV and the NKJV are the worst translations you could use. And I think that's important for people in my church to know, because I think a lot of you like the KJV and you think it's the only one that's reliable. I, for 10 years, preached with the NKJV in my church in Texas because I thought, well, it's like the KJV, but it's more modern, so I like it. But then when I read what Gordon Fee said, I quit using it and I switched to the NIV of 2011, because the NIV of 1984 I don't like, but the NIV of 2011 is much better. But the reason Gordon Fee says NKJV and KJV are no good, they're the worst translations, are because you got to understand this, folks. You got to understand this. When the KJV was done, it was a beautiful translation. It was the best ever done at that time. And many people love the old King James English and so forth. But you got to understand, they only had very late manuscripts from the medieval times to use. So they were actually referring to manuscripts that had accumulated mistakes for over 1,000 years. It was 1,000 years of copying errors, okay? And none of these mistakes, or few of them anyway, make any difference to us doctrinally. but they often do make a difference in the meaning of lots of texts. Like there's even old-time words like peradventure and, you know, those of us who are alive and remain will not prevent those who have gone on to Christ. You know, prevent used to mean will not go before. Today doesn't mean go before. It means stop. So there's a lot of words that have changed. And so the thing is that the KJV was a beautiful Bible for 300 years. It was used by English speakers, but they had very poor manuscripts to use to translate from. So today we have much better stuff. The scholars have much better manuscripts that have been found over the many intervening, you know, centuries of time. And so it's far more reliable, far more in line with what the original writers wrote, the modern versions, right? And so the NKJV wanted to get rid of the archaic language, but that's what a lot of people thought was beautiful about the King James Bible. But they still used the crummy Greek texts, so it's the very worst to use. But the thing is, it's also important to understand that different translations try to accomplish different goals. And Gordon Fee and Douglas Stewart talk about this. There's what's called formal equivalence, and that means you're trying to be more literal, right? Trying to be just like literally what the Greek and the Hebrew says, as close as you can to the original. So it's more literal. That would be versions like the NASB and the RSV and the NRSB. But then there's something called functional equivalence, where you're not trying to be exactly literal like the original languages because they didn't speak like we do today. You're trying instead to get the point across, right? What was the point? Not word for word, but meaning for meaning is what you're trying to get. And that would be like the NIV, the NAB, the NJB, the GNB, lots of versions like that. Then there are what you call free translations. They're more paraphrases, like the Living Bible or the Message. But the problem with them is that sometimes they're too free, and it ends up being that the translator is kind of making it say things the way he would say them or the way he'd like them to be said. And sometimes, you know, his doctrine comes out, or his way of looking at things comes out. And that's not what you want. You don't want that human bias or influence. You want it to say what it actually said as best you can, you know, in the language that you're translating to. And so I've come to like the NLT, the New Living Translation, because it's like the Living Bible, but it was compiled by a group of scholars, not just one guy. Like the Living Bible was put together by Ken Taylor, but the New Living was put together by a group of scholars. So it's more literal than the Living, but it's still in a modern kind of way of expressing things. What I want to say as I wrap up here, though, what I want to urge you to do is to understand, number one, you don't have to be afraid of all these different versions. There's some that are biased and they have a bad motivation. Yes, okay, avoid them. But most of these other versions were put together by scholars, and they're just trying to translate it, you know, into the formal equivalent or into the dynamic equivalent the best they can to make it to where it's more understandable to people today. So what I recommend to everybody is don't just read the Bible in one version. Sure, if you like to have a handheld physical book, okay, you gotta have just one version. Okay, fine. Buy a more modern version. Don't read King James. Read something more modern. Or sometimes you can get a parallel, you know, it's got two or three versions. But even if you have to buy just one version, look, here's what I recommend. Go online and just type in the search bar whatever chapter you want to read, like say 1 Corinthians 12, just type that in. You know what it'll do? It'll bring up Bible Gateway, and you can go there, click on Bible Gateway, and then you'll have the option to read that chapter in about as many versions as you can think of, just for free. So, you know, there's ways to read many different versions online. There's also stuff today like YouVersion. I have YouVersion on my phone. You download it, it's an app. And then you can read the Bible in lots of different versions right on your phone. See, folks, you don't have to be afraid of the different versions. You just need to compare them. Biblical interpretation is really a science. And with all the manuscripts that have been found and all the groups of scholars working on these translations over the years, nobody can really get away with making something up. There's too many other options, too many other versions to look at. You can go check. If you read something and it seems weird to you, go read another version and you'll see, you know, oh yeah, that's not really what it says in any other version. I mean, if you find one that says it a certain way and it seems a little odd, go read others. And if you find 10 other versions that don't agree, well, there you got your answer, right? So anyway, I hope this helps. I'm just trying to get people to understand that what different denominations are and what the different versions of the Bible are. God bless you. Thanks for listening today. If you have any comments, questions, or prayer requests, I'd be happy to receive them from you. Just scroll down and you can send them from the website directly. Also, if you'd like to support this ministry, you can do it on the website by clicking the donate button or contact me to make a different arrangement. Thank you.